First of all, I refused to come for all those years out of spite because you took LeBron back. But the truth is, we're very happy for you. You deserve it. I hope you enjoy it while it lasts. It's a great honor and a privilege to be here. It's great to be in Cleveland because you're a renowned community, and it's really an honor to be here with Rabbi Blau. My family goes back with Rabbi Blau, without exaggeration, for four generations. His great-grandfather, Rabbi Prail, in Elizabeth, my great-grandfather was the shochet for Rabbi Prail. Our grandparents were friends, our parents are close, and so it's really an honor and a privilege. I remember towards the end of my grandparents' lives when they were living in Elizabeth, Rabbi Blau was the rabbi there at the time, and I know my family and I are forever indebted for the kindness and the honor and the respect that you showed them during that time. And I'm indebted for your friendship today, and so really it's an honor. Thank you so much for having me. The Green Road Synagogue, the Cleveland community, you have so much to be proud of. You are a flagship religious Zionist community, and we around the country look at you, your ability to instill passion within young people, and enthusiasm and energy for Judaism, for a love of Israel, is something which is very, very special. So for that too, I thank you for having me here. And I want to acknowledge and thank my hosts, who also happen to be my cousins, Hildy and Gary Weiss. It's wonderful to spend time with you, and thank you for your great hospitality, your delicious meatballs, and everything else. And to see so many familiar faces. I didn't realize how many people I knew in Cleveland. To see so many people connected to our shul and our community, it's really special. And I'm glad only because you mentioned Mr. Sanders, Mike Sanders, who's a neighbor, a dear friend, a teacher, a mentor. If we are blessed to be experiencing growth and wonderful things in Boca, so much of it is on the merit of Mr. Sanders. To watch him daven, to see his kavana, his midos, is something I know this community knows very well, and we are the beneficiaries of. We're so, so blessed to have him. So I'm glad that you mentioned his name. So the topic tonight, the building blocks of authentic modern orthodoxy. This is a complicated title. What are building blocks? What does it mean to be authentic? How do you define modern orthodoxy, a term that means something else to everyone who uses it? So I want to begin tonight by talking a little bit, not about what authentic modern orthodox is, but I want to begin with two points about what modern orthodoxy is not. Misconceptions, I think, that people have about modern orthodoxy. And I want to do so not through the prism of my own eyes, not my own suggestions. You can accuse me, who knows where I am on the spectrum today of orthodoxy. But I want to do so through the eyes and through the words and through the wisdom of someone that it's undeniable. One can't debate his modern orthodox credentials. The father, so to say, the Gadol Hador of modern orthodoxy, and that is the Rav himself, Zatzal, Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik. And Parshat Pekudei, in the second of the Parshios that we're going to read this week, Eile Pekudei HaMishkan, Moshe is taking an accounting of the Mishkan. Like any good, I see there's a capital campaign taking place. Like any good capital campaign, you have to present at the end a balanced budget. You have to show that all the income, all the revenue you took in, was spent. There has to be a transparency. You have to show that it's balanced. Moshe is doing the calculations. 1,775 shekel, he comes up short. He knows he takes it in. He understands he took in the donations. He can't figure out what did he spend it on. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Almighty, showed him. He forgot to calculate the vavim, the hooks that held up the curtains of the Mishkan. You forgot to include. The Gemara in Bechoros Daf Hei records a conversation not between Moshe and Hashem, but a conversation between a non-Jew and Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. And the Gemara tells the story that this non-Jew tells Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, you know, there were 603,550 members of Klal Yisrael at the time of the building of the Mishkan. And he did the calculation. If each gave a half shekel of silver, there are over 200 kikarim of silver. And yet Moshe used less than half to make these sockets. So he said, what happened? The same question, the 1,775 shekel. If the money, less than half, was used on the sockets, where was that missing money? To which Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, not the Almighty himself this time, replies to this non-Jew, you're only counting the money that was used for the sockets. But don't forget the money that was used for the hooks, the vavim, that which held the sockets together. And the Rav wondered, and you can see this in the recently published Rav Chumash by the OU. The Rav wondered, what is the nature of this conversation? What was the non-Jew arguing to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai? And what was Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai answering? And the Rav explained, and I'm reading to you the Rav's words. The non-Jewish world does not understand why we are so concerned with details. Why do we not have a system which would free us from having to keep mitzvahs that are difficult to observe under specific circumstance? Why is there any significance to the tiny hooks? Why should they be accounted for? They're negligible. The little details, the minutiae, the laws, they seem so insignificant. They're so unimportant. Why are we so obsessed? Why do we care so much? Can't we dispose of them? Can't we negotiate them away? Can't we compromise on them? Why do they have to count? And what was Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai's response? He said, no, you don't get it. Without the little hooks, without the details, without the minutiae, the sockets can't work. They can't hold up the building. The building implodes. It falls apart. It comes down. It's not just about the major rules and principles, the sockets, but it's the details. It's the rigorous observance of halacha, which holds up the entire edifice, without which it would come crumbling down. The Pew study tells us, and we don't need it to tell us, that the greater the attention to the details, to the minutiae, the more the observance of the laws which seem negotiable, that seem like the vavim, that seem perhaps arguably insignificant, but the more devotion to them, the less assimilation, the greater the continuity, the greater the Jewish identity. You don't need a Pew study to know that. We know that the existence of our people, that our continuity relies not just on our attention to the sockets, to the big principles, to the important, you know, the Decalogue, the Aseres HaDibros, to be a good person, a kind person. Those are all really important. But it's the details. It's what we sometimes dismiss as the insignificant minutiae which really matter. And so the first misconception about what modern orthodoxy is that I want to dispel before we try to define modern orthodoxy is that modern orthodoxy means it's a license to pick and choose. Modern orthodoxy means that I'm not obligated, I'm not bound by the totality of Jewish law. Those are minutiae, those are details. We, the modern orthodox, concern ourselves with the sockets, with the big principle, the big ticket items. It's not true. And it's Rabbi Soloveitchik's own insight that without attention to the details, without caring about the halacha, the entire edifice comes crumbling down. And I want to be clear. It's not an all or nothing type of thing. It doesn't mean that if you can't observe every detail of halacha scrupulously and vigilantly, then you might as well not bother. Of course not. It's not all or nothing. We all try our hardest. It's whatever degree we can that we observe. But the aspiration of our movement, the aspiration of our community has to be not just about the sockets, but about the hooks, about the vavim that collectively together hold up the edifice. The second insight I want to share to begin to dispel a misconception what modern orthodoxy is not is another insight of Rabbi Soloveitchik. It appears similarly, and he probably received it from his great-grandfather, the Beis HaLevi. The Meshech Chochma has a similar comment. We know that Vayakel Pekudei, what we're going to read this week, you open your Mikraos Gedolos, you see very little commentary. Rabbis struggle. What drasha are we going to get this week that we didn't already give 2 and 3 weeks ago on Truma and Tetzaveh? Because Vayakel Pekudei is almost an exact replication. It seems so redundant. We're repeating the same dimensions of the Mishkan and the utensils that were in there and the description of the Big Day Kahuna, the priestly garments. Why are we repeating it over and over and over again? And said the Rav, based on his great-grandfather, the Beis HaLevi, we're repeating it because there are 5 words which are added throughout these parshios. And this week, when you're hearing Kriyas HaTorah, pay attention in the Chumash, and you'll see these words that are not present in Truma Tetzaveh. And they are the words, Kasher Tziva Hashem Es Moshe, as God commanded Moshe. And why are they significant? And why are they here? And why are we repeating all of this after we just had it in Truma Tetzaveh? And they explain. Because Kisisa came in between. The story of the Chet HaEgel. The Chet HaEgel, the Jewish people, just stood under the chuppah of Har Sinai. It's their wedding night with the Almighty. And I won't describe graphically because it would seem inappropriate, but on their very wedding night with the Almighty, having just emerged from under the chuppah, the Jewish people have an act of great infidelity. To build and worship an idol on your wedding night? To cheat? to leave, to abandon, to violate the sanctity of the relationship on the wedding night? It's just simply incomprehensible. Particularly for a generation who experienced unprecedented and unparalleled revelation, providence, the 10 plagues, the splitting of the sea, the kindness. It's impossible. Because Ari Rav Yehuda HaLevi, based on Levi, all explain that the Chet HaEgel, the sin of the golden calf, is not an act of idolatry. It's a misconception. The Jewish people were not abandoning or violating God to worship an idol, but actually, to a certain kind of paradoxical way, it was a beautiful, noble pursuit of the relationship with God Himself. You see, the people were so desperate to feel connected to Hashem. When Moshe was around, they had a physical medium, a tangible symbol or representative of Hashem in their lives. It's really hard, as we all know, to connect to God. You can't see Him, you can't feel Him, you can't hear Him, you can't touch Him, you can't smell Him. It's very hard to connect. So when they would see Moshe Rabbeinu, they knew he was the symbol, the medium through which they connected. And when Moshe didn't come back, they panicked. What will we do now? How do we connect now? They said, you know what? We're going to try something. We're going to innovate. We'll be creative. We'll take initiative. We're going to build a calf. And that will be the tangible physical manifestation through which we will connect with Hashem. And Moshe comes down and he smashes the luchos. And the symbol of his smashing the luchos is the message he's sending. You can't put God in a box. You can't contain God in something tangible or physical, whether it's an idol or even whether it's the luchos. God can't be captured in the physical material realm. But nevertheless, Hashem says, you know, it's reasonable. I understand your need. I created you as physical beings in a physical world, and it's a legitimate need to try to connect to me through something physical. So I'm going to respect that need, and God says, therefore, I'm going to give you something called the Mishkan, a physical, tangible place where you'll be able to go and connect to me. Kalim, the utensils of the Mishkan, the Big Day Kahuna, Lechavan Luciferus, that are so beautiful, that are filled with glory and honor. I will prescribe for you physical components through which to relate to me. Don't innovate, don't create. It's a legitimate, noble need, but you can't do it on your own. I'm the Almighty. I'm the omnipotent being who created the universe and everything in it. And I prescribe the best way for you to connect to me. You can't figure it out on your own. And so the Mishkan is repeated. Vayakel Pekude. Except this time, says the Beis HaLevi, we have the addition of Kasher Tziva Hashem Es Moshe. As God commanded Moshe. As God commanded Moshe. As God commanded Moshe. Over and over and over again. Because the message is that even when we have the most noble intent, even when we have the most sincere, authentic desire, we're trying to innovate or create, we're trying to introduce new positions, new ideas, new rituals, new practices, new opportunities, we're not allowed to violate Kasher Tziva Hashem Es Moshe. It has to be within the Mesorah. And I think this is a second misconception about the modern Orthodox community, that we're innovators, that we create, that we are allowed to initiate. And we do. There's a lot of innovative approaches. We have innovative programs. We have innovative language through which we capture in a modern way ancient ideas. But at our core, we are a Mesorah community. We are bound by that same Kasher Tziva Hashem Es Moshe. And we measure the metrics through which we evaluate whether everything we want to do is authentic or counterfeit. Does it meet the standard Kasher Tziva Hashem Es Moshe? Is it part of the Mesorah? And the Baalei HaMesorah of every generation who are able to intuit the Ratzon Hashem, does this meet that standard? Yes, we have Shabbos elevators, and yes, we have selling of chametz, and yes, we have the Priz Bowl, which seem like halacha changes. But it doesn't. Halacha meets the changing world, but the halacha itself is something which is stable. And we rely on and we trust the Baalei HaMesorah. So modern orthodoxy is not about getting to pick and choose or ignoring or neglecting the minutiae and details. We leave that to others. We focus on the big sockets. We care equally about the minutiae and details. And modern orthodoxy is not licensed to innovate and create and try out new things and be able to, you know, it's like you go to a doctor and the doctor diagnoses an issue and prescribes a medicine, but you went on WebMD the night before your doctor's appointment. So you leave the doctor's office and you say, I appreciate the diagnosis. He prescribed, she prescribed A. I'm going to try B. I read somewhere on the internet B's better. We'd say, you're a fool. What do you mean you're trying B? The doctor went to medical school and residency and fellowship and has years of practice and intuition of what's right. And you're going to ignore the prescription of the authority to try it on your own? Halacha and Jewish life is not something that we get to experiment or try on our own. There's a prescription. And the opening mission of Pirkei Avos tells us the prescription was handed down from God to Moshe, and Moshe to Yeshua, and Yeshua to the Zakenim. And that's part of the chain of Masorah that we, our community, is equally bound by. So if those are two things that we're not, what are we? And why is this initiative tonight so impressive, so important? And I think it will be so transformative because a similar initiative in our community had and is having that impact, and I'm excited to tell you about it. So first of all, I want to just dispel, despite the title, with the notion of the label modern Orthodox. We don't believe in labels. Labels are unhealthy. All they do is divide rather than unite. And certainly we know that our people could use more and more unity. We don't need different names and different labels and different boxes to fit in where we go, where we'll never go, who we talk to, who we'd never be caught dead with. So the labels are unhealthy. The labels we don't need. We have one Torah. We're one Jewish people. We stood at Har Sinai, and we did not have different shuls at Har Sinai. We were all together, one people. And so I just want to dispel, despite our attempt to define the name, that it's a very unhealthy thing to have it to begin with. So let's dispel with the name, but let's just talk about what we know that binds the Cleveland and Boca Raton communities together. What is the fabric? What drives our community? What's our collective mission that we live with, we strive for, and that we hope our children will have an equal devotion to as well? So, clearly, one thing that distinguishes us, and I don't want to talk about this, are some of the particulars. We have an emphasis on the value of general education. We care about, in this community as a model, religious Zionism, the role, the religious nature of the role of the modern state of Israel, greater women's roles and greater women's influence. We care about those things, but I'll tell you a little secret off the record is that our community is winning that battle because if you look to the community to the right of us, they too now are getting education and having professions. They too now are part of the U.S.-Israel relationship advocacy and saying Tehillim for soldiers in the army. And they too are making allowances for women in ways that heretofore had not yet happened. So those are not, I think, the dividing lines. While they still remain particular differences, I don't think that's the flag that we wave who we are. I think our mission is something a little broader, it's something a little bigger, and it's really what I want to speak to you about tonight. And Rabbi Blau is going to wave to me when I run out of time. My flight is not till midday tomorrow, so as far as I'm concerned, I have a lot of time. What I think distinguishes us more is really more about our worldview. It's about our approach. It's really what you spoke about really very beautifully, and I'm happy that I can try to build on the ideas that you mentioned. Part of the Jewish community, a significant part of the Torah observant Jewish community, is defined by an approach of retreat, by segregating, by insulating, by isolating from the outside world. The outside world is too threatening. There's too much that can contaminate, it's too toxic, and so we insulate and we isolate. And the largest segment of the Jewish world, not the Torah Jewish world, is going to the opposite extreme. The outside world is so appealing. And in fact, it's so inviting and welcoming in an unprecedented way. It's so enriching that this group has assimilated and integrated at levels the Jewish people have never, ever experienced. To the degree that just a week or two ago, and I don't share this triumphantly, I share it very sadly, the conservative movement voted, 90% voted, to accept non-Jews as members of their congregations. That's how far that level of assimilation and integration has gone. So there are those who are retreat, they're in retreat, seclusion, isolation, insulation. There are those who are assimilating and integrating and blending. And where does that leave us? Where does that leave our community? Where do we see our role? What is our mandate? What is our mission? What am I so excited about to be part of this community, our collective community? Torah tells us when God takes us out of Mitzrayim, which we're going to celebrate, I don't want anyone to have heart palpitations or a panic attack, but we're going to celebrate very shortly. And God doesn't take us out of Mitzrayim in order to create us into a secular entity, a secular people. There were plenty of secular nations and people around the world. That was not why He took us out, and He wasn't ambiguous about it. He makes very, very clear throughout the Sefer that we are concluding this week, throughout Sefer Shmos, that He took us out of Egypt. That's only half. It's not only that where He took us out from, but it's the destination He took us to. Har Sinai, Matan Torah, that He took us in order to be His avadim. He took us in order to give us a mission in life. He fashioned us into a goy kadosh, into a mamlechas kohanim. We became the nation of priests. What does it mean to be a nation of priests? Rav Avraham ben Arambam, the Rambam's son, has a commentary on Chumash. And he has incredible comment, which for the sake of time I won't read to you verbatim. But he says, the priests are charged with being the inspiration, the role models of whatever people they are the priests of. We, the Jewish people, are the priests of humanity, of the world community. We are charged with a mission of teaching the world God's blueprint, how we're supposed to act and conduct ourselves. What does it mean to relate to food? What does it mean to relate to pleasure? What does it mean to relate to money? What does it mean to relate to desire and appetite? What does it mean to relate to charity and justice? What does it mean to relate to time? What are relationships all about? We, the Jewish people, through our sacred Torah and through the mitzvos, are given the mission and the mandate not to seclude ourselves, not to be obsessed with the minutiae as if they are the ends unto themselves, but to live life with the recognition that the minutiae and details matter. Why? Because they cultivate and refine us into a people who are a mamleches kohanim. We are priests, we are role models. We are to be God's ambassadors to the world, engaged with the world, contributing to the world, drawing and taking the best from the world, but never, ever losing our core identity, never forgetting who we are. When Avram Avinu buys Maras Machpelah from Ephron Hachiti, he introduces himself and he says, I am both a resident, ger v'toshav anochi imachem. I am both a stranger, a ger, v'toshav, and a resident at the same time. I am both part of and apart from you. On the one hand, I'm a resident. I live with you. And I can connect with you. And we can have interpersonal relationships and economic relationships and social relationships. We can have governance relationships. But on the other hand, as much as I'm part of society, I am apart from society. Ger v'toshav anochi imachem. And the Rav said, that is what it means to be a Torah Jew. Is to not run and isolate and segregate and seclude, but on the other hand, not to ever, God forbid, assimilate and forget who we are and where we come from. There are generations that struggle. They for a long time forgot that they were a toshav. They always knew they were different because the countries in which we were living never let us forget. Through oppression and persecution and through putting us in ghettos, we knew that we were a ger. We knew we were a stranger. We never had a havamina. We never had a thought that we were a toshav. And today we live in a generation that has the opposite problem. It's so easy to be a toshav. It's so easy to be a resident and a citizen, to be part of the Weltanschauung of the world, to be part of the values and the mores of the world, that we forget to ever emphasize the component that we're also a ger. We have to remember that to a degree we're a stranger. We're part of and we're apart from at the same time. But Rabbeinu Yonah says that's why the Jewish people were created. We were created to repair the world, to transform the world, to elevate and enrich the world, to teach the world as a mamleches kohanim, what it means to relate to all of these different areas. By the way, to a large degree, we've succeeded in our generation. We can appreciate this. When the founding fathers of this great country built it on principles and values, they were Judeo-Christian, they were Judeo-values. John Adams wrote, I will insist the Hebrews have done more to civilize man than any other people. And the language of our Constitution, the language of the Declaration of Independence, the language of the document of the Founding Fathers, uses the language of our sacred Torah. Charity, justice, equality of all men, because God endows us with Tzelem Elokim. These are all Jewish ideas. Only because we were part of the world were we able to contribute them. Were we able to shape them. Were we able to influence them. That's our mission. That's why we're here. Kiddush Hashem. And so the minutiae and the details matter. They're non-negotiable. But they matter not on an ends unto themselves to be obsessive, compulsive, neurotic about, to find the latest stringency about. They matter because together they weave the platform that enables us to accomplish that greater goal of transforming the world, of being the Mamleches Kohanim, of being the role models for the world. I only first came to appreciate this a couple of years ago, sadly, that we actually affirm this mission every time we say Kedusha. I don't know, in Nusach Sfar, do you say the same exact question? I have to think for a second. But when we say Kedusha, what do we say? Nikadesh Hashemcha Ba'olam, Keshem Shemakdishim Oso B'Shmei Marom. Nikadesh Hashemcha Ba'olam. God, you know what my job is? I realize it. I realize it when I start my day in the morning, and I realize it towards the end of my day at Mincha, when I'm evaluating my day. That I know my mission, personally, individually, collectively, nationally, is Nikadesh Hashemcha Ba'olam. That ultimately my goal is to bring more and more people closer to your name, to sanctify your world, to teach the world in an age of technology the value of disconnecting to connect. Just a few weeks ago, there was an initiative, I don't even know who led it, but it was a group of Jews to try to, I saw there were many secular newspapers, magazines that picked up on the story, try to convince people for this Saturday, a weekend of disconnect, that everyone be technology free for 24 hours, to follow the model of Shabbos. We are going to be studied very shortly. Make no mistake about it. Sociologists are going to find Orthodox communities and ask to do studies of us because we, and maybe the Amish, we will be the last remnant of human beings on earth capable of going 24 hours without touching our phone, without checking Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, seeing the news feed, answering the texts. We are the last vestiges on earth capable of doing it. And as much as all of us are addicted to the degree that on Shabbos we have a phantom limb syndrome where you can sometimes feel your phone vibrate in your pocket even though it's obviously not there, but we are liberated, we're emancipated. We can appreciate more than anyone else, Shabbos is Zecher Yetzias Mitzrayim. Shabbos is liberty, emancipation, freedom. We're able to disconnect and therefore we're able to connect to what really matters. Take that value alone. Take that attitude towards technology alone. Nikadesh Hashemcha Ba'olam. We can teach the world. We've been given the tools and we've been given the language. And work, you mentioned, that so many people, because we are a community that are professionals, that work, that are involved in the world, that interact with the world. For us, and this is also this week's Pasha, Shesh Hashamim Te'aseh Melacha. 6 days you work and the seventh day you rest. Why didn't the Torah just begin with rest on the seventh day? And why are we modeling it after God, that God worked 6 days and then we rested on the seventh day? And the answer is very simple. Because to us, to our community in particular, work is not a concession. Work is not a dirty word. Work is a value. Work is something that's part of our mission. Work is an essential human obligation. It's a central pillar of our mission on earth to conquer the world, to understand it, to manipulate it, to be able to contribute towards it. Christians saw work as punishment. It's a concession. We have to work, otherwise, how will we live? But Jews see work not as a concession and not as a punishment. To us, work is a calling. Avos Derbi Nosson, Perek Yud Aleph, says that just like Hashem worked 6 days and then He rested, we work 6 days. Shabbos only has meaning when you work for 6 days beforehand. It's a covenant we have with the Almighty. The Mishnah in Avos tells us in the second parak that Torah needs derech eretz in order to endure. It means that the work has value. Work is v'halachta bedrachav. We imitate Hashem. If work had no value, God wouldn't have been described as engaging in it. The world would just be described as coming into existence, and then Hashem rested. The fact that the Torah testifies that God worked means it has an inherent value. And we imitate God. We differentiate ourselves from the rest of creation. We imitate Hashem by working. And working is that platform for Nekadesh Hashemcha Ba'olam. We transform and repair the world through the interactions we have. Are we kind? Are we courteous? Are we honest? When people see us with a kippah, when they know that we're an observant Jew, and we hold to our word, and our word is our bond, and we show up on time, and we deliver on time, then we are repairing Hashem's world. That's part of our community's mission and emphasis. I'm sad to tell you that if you look in the Webster's Dictionary, and if it's not still in 2017, it was a few years ago. If you look in the Webster's Dictionary on the definition of what it means to Jew, they actually had it as an entry in the dictionary, to Jew is to cheat. Could you imagine? Shouldn't the Webster's Dictionary definition of to Jew be to be honest and kind and courteous and just, and charitable and good and decent? That's our mission, to change the definition in the dictionary. And Judaism was not just meant for the Jews. Judaism was meant for us to share them with the world. We are mamleches kohanim, and we're not just priests for priests. We're priests for the non-priests, which are the rest of the world. Avram Avinu does not retreat into a life of religious growth on his own. The Rambam in Moreh Nevuchim writes that Avram is out in the world making it a better place. And what it means to be the disciples, the children, the descendants, the progeny of Avram Avinu means to be out in the world making it a better place, transforming it. To be the disciples of Avram Avinu is not to be frum per se. It's to be erlich. And it's to bring that Ehrlichkeit to the world, to repair it and to improve it, and to brighten it, just like Avram Avinu did. That's his legacy. Avram Avinu's legacy, though the Medrash tells us he kept Tarig Mitzvos, but his legacy is not the scrupulous observance of Chumras and Mitzvos. Avram's legacy is transforming the world. And those are the footsteps that we are meant to walk in. In Aleinu, you know, the only place... They say the joke about a Federation mission to Israel, where one of the members of the mission asked the Israeli tour guide, how do you say Tikkun Olam in Hebrew? It's such a catchphrase that people don't even realize. Now, I once heard Rabbi Pelkovitz, he should be well, say, the only time it says Tikkun Olam, the only time we have that is in Aleinu. And it's followed by two more words. L'saken Olam b'malchus shakai. To repair the world, but not to repair the world based on the way we humans see, not to repair the world with humanism, to repair the world to be a kingdom for God, Nekadesh Hashemcha Ba'olam, to realize. So to me, the building blocks of authentic modern orthodoxy are to engage scrupulous Torah and mitzvos, but not as an ends, as the means to fulfill our greater mission, to transform the world, to repair the world, to have a legacy of making the world a better place. And what does it mean to be a better place? It means to be a more godly place, to be a more pure place, a more holy place, a more values-driven place, a more moral place, a more modest place, a more just place, a more charitable place, a more selfless place. All the values inherent underwriting all of our mitzvahs, informing all that we do, that's our mission. Not to keep it as a secret to ourselves, but to share it with the world and to transform the world. And I think this is not only something which is true, I think strategically it's what we need to do. I don't know about in Cleveland, but I know in Boca, and I speak to my colleagues in many other places, that greater than the tuition crisis, which remains, although in Cleveland I hear it's not such a crisis. Thinking about moving here, I heard about the vouchers. But the tuition crisis in other places that still don't have vouchers, although we don't have state income tax, so maybe we'll stay where we are. But the tuition crisis is not the real crisis. The crisis is when you're going to pay that tuition and graduate a disaffected, uninspired child or student. We're all struggling and suffering with the toshav, anochi imachem, that our children have access to the world and an invitation to the world, and it's very, very welcoming. It's very attractive to join the world. And we're struggling with our disaffected, uninspired youth. And I think that we need to change the language in the conversation. Of course we have to keep teaching about halacha. And of course the details matter. They're binding. They're non-negotiable. They are the vavim. They're the hooks that hold the sockets and the entire building up. Of course we have to teach it. But we have to teach that it's not an ends, it's a means to the greater mission, to the greater purpose, to teach every one of our Jewish children that their role and their job in life is not just to earn more money or have a nicer house or drive a nicer car or play more on Xbox or enjoy more Starbucks lattes. They wake up every day with a mission, and that they exist if God has renewed their contract. If they are here, they have an exclusive, singular purpose that no one else on earth could fill. That God is waiting for them. That God needs them. That we need them to change the world. Nobody gets more excited or enthusiastic than when you're tapped with a mission. When you feel you have a purpose and a drive. These details don't just restrict you and bind you and hold you back, but these details are there to give you a charge to play a sacred role in the world. I think it could inspire our next generation that this Judaism gives us the tools for mindfulness and for values and for meaning and for true happiness. Things that the whole world is stumbling around looking for. You don't have to. Shelley Sanders and I like to share the books that we read. Every book is about how can I find happiness? How can I find meaning? How do you define meaning? What are values? Everybody's searching and struggling, and we've got the secret. Why are we keeping it to ourselves and failing to tell our children that it's not just about the rules? The rules are there because they lead to a life of purpose and meaning and mission and fulfillment and mindfulness and consciousness. They give us the tools to disconnect in a connected world and so on. So how do we do it? I have a couple more minutes left, just a couple. Okay. So how do we do it? So this time of the year, we're obsessed with a search and destroy mission. The enemy is chametz. And the mission is to turn our houses upside down to find it and to eliminate it. And why are we so obsessed with it? Talk about the minutiae and the details and the negligible. Literally, the crumbs. Chametz is asur b'mashehu. Negligible. A nothing. Insignificant. Imagine what that non-Jew, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, would say about the chametz asur b'mashehu. Why are we so obsessed? The Gemara in Baruchas Yud Zayin tells us that chametz represents the Seor Shebe'isa as the Yetzahara. It represents this inclination, this urge, this impulse in us. That the search for chametz is not really all about chametz. It's not your Shabbos Agav B'drasham, okay? The search for chametz is not really, it's not really about the chametz. It's about the chametz as a symbol and manifestation of the chametz that's inside us. Of the impulse, the urge, what we're fighting within us. And what is it that we're fighting? So the Gemara says the Seor Shebe'isa is the Yetzahara, but which Yetzahara? We have a lot of Yetzaharas. Which Yetzahara exactly are we searching and destroying? Are we trying to eliminate from our midst? But Menachem Kasher in his Haggadah Shlema has a beautiful essay where he shows, and I'm not going to elaborate on it now, but he shows a parallel between the laws of Chametz and the laws of Avodah Zarah, the laws of idolatry. Both are forbidden to own. And both need to be burnt. And both are forbidden in Hana, they're also to benefit from. And both are asur b'mashu, both you're not allowed to have even in a negligible amount. And both can be eradicated by bittul with nullification. And both prohibitions demand a bedika, a search. There are countless parallels between the laws of chametz and the laws of Avodah Zarah. And if you look at the language when we're leaving Egypt, the original references to our leaving Egypt, you see, Mashku Yedeichem, get rid, cleanse your hands from any reference to idolatry. Pesach is an exercise in ridding ourselves of idolatrous ideas and influences. And Chametz is the contemporary symbol or manifestation of Avodah Zarah that we're trying to get rid of. What is Avodah Zarah? If I asked you at face value, anyone here have a Yetzirah for Avodah Zarah? Yeah, we have Yetzirah for all kinds of things. I don't need to list them. Avodah Zarah probably doesn't make the top 3, the top 10, maybe not the top 100. But that's only when you think of Avodah Zarah in the classic sense of a little stone idol. What Avodah Zarah really is, it's Avodah, which is Zarah, Zar. It's any type of effort, work, the pursuit of something which is Zar, which is strange, which is foreign to our value system. When we care about, when we pursue, when we integrate into our own values things that are foreign to us, that's the worship of Avodah Zarah. Idolatry is not just bowing down to a statue. Idolatry is bowing down to LeBron James. that okay? Is that safe to say? Okay, not LeBron James. But idolatry is bowing down. We are living in a world of great confusion. And I'm not going to get into the distraction by naming the issues, but we all know that there are moral issues in the greater world around us about gender, about relationships, about a lot of things, where the question becomes, what drives our attitude, our approach? What helps us arrive at our conclusion about what we believe about the contemporary issues of the day? If it's Torah, if it's Judaism, then it's authentic. But if it's the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, if it's what's popular, if it's what the pop culture is telling us, and the pundits, and the talking heads, and the pressure of those around us, that's avoda, which is zara. That's subscribing to a value which is foreign, which is apart, which is different. Pesach and the month of Nisan leading up to it is an exercise in evaluating what in our own beliefs, what in our own values, what in our own practices don't belong. They're foreign. They shouldn't be part of our repertoire. They shouldn't be in our toolbox. They shouldn't be part of who we are. Rabbi Lau in his Haggadah Yachol Yisrael says, Mitchila Ovdei Avodah Zarah, the fact that we begin the Gnus, we mentioned that we were idolaters. If you apply b'chol dor v'dor chayav adam liros ha'atzma, that in every generation we have to see ourselves as leaving, we don't get to start the script and the story from when we're leaving. To fulfill seeing yourself in every generation as leaving begins with seeing yourself as mitchila ovdei avodah zarah. That we too have elements and residue of avodah zarah in our lives. Values that don't belong, practices that don't belong, magazines and websites and TV shows that don't belong, that are bringing ideas and that are bringing priorities which are not our own. Rav Pinkus writes that if Tishrei is about evaluating our behavior before Rosh Hashanah, then Nisan is about evaluating our beliefs. Tishrei is about what we do and getting it right, and Nisan is about what we believe and getting it right. We can't lose our Jewish soul. Because our freedom that we were granted is not about liberty, but it's to fulfill this mission. It's to be a covenantal community. And at the core of fulfilling our mission is knowing who we are, is knowing what our mission is about, is staying true to the mission. Gemara tells us in Shabbos that when we all get upstairs after 120, we'll be asked a series of questions. And one of them is Kavata Itim LaTorah, which is what tonight is all about. Do we designate time for Torah study? Is it part of our schedule? Do we make time for Torah? Which we'll get back to in a moment. But I once heard a suggestion, an alternative interpretation. Kavata itim l'Torah is not about, did you set aside time for Torah, but kavata itim l'Torah or kavata Torah li'itim. Itim can also mean the times. Not a newspaper, but the times in which you're living. The contemporary times. Kavata itim l'Torah. Did you look at the issues of the day through the prism of Torah to determine what's correct, what's true, what's just, what's authentic? Not necessarily because of what the op-ed and editorial say, but what do Torah tell me is true? Or kavata Torah le'itim. Do you look at the times and then try to make the Torah conform, make the Torah fit, distort, manipulate Torah so that it can match and so that it can fit with the times in which we live? So how do we know whether Avodah Zarah has seeped into our lives? How do we know if we have foreign influences and values that are compromising our ability to fulfill our mission of the Kadesh Shemcha Ba'olam? And the answer is, Bedikas Chametz. We search for Chametz. And how do we search for Chametz? It's not a coincidence that even though today we have electricity, and there's a big discussion in Halacha, can you leave the lights on, do you use a flashlight? But the Minag Yisrael, I bet if I took a poll, is to still light a candle and to walk room to room with the wooden mixing spoon and the feather and the rag and a candle. Why are we using a candle? It's so inefficient. It's dangerous. A flashlight, you have the light. You have your iPhone flashlight, Android flashlight. What are you using a candle? And the answer, I think, is simple. Because that light, as we search for chametz, is not just about the illumination to find the leaven. But the Gemara Megillah tells us, Ora zu Torah. The light of the candle is the symbol of Torah. You want to know if you have foreign influences? You want to find the chametz of your life. You're going to look in the cracks and crevices. You want to see if there are things that don't really belong, that are compromising who we are and our mission. Then the way to find it is the light of Torah. It's studying Torah. It's being grounded in Torah. It's using Torah as the prism and the magnifying glass and the metric through which we measure everything in life to know whether it belongs there, whether it's right. And it's why I applaud the Meekly family. This program is so incredibly important. A community, a modern Orthodox community as much or more than any other, because we're engaged with the outside world, because part of the fabric, part of the basic foundation of our existence is this mission of transforming the world. We, more than anyone else, need self-evaluation and self-awareness over and over again to know whether what we're doing is authentic and true. Does it meet the criteria of Torah? And if we're not steeped and grounded in Torah learning and Torah living, we can find ourselves contaminated with things without even realizing it to begin with. So you'll say, who has time for Torah? So busy, running here, there, work, gym, shopping, keeping up. Who has time for anything? And the answer is, we have time if we're honest with ourselves. We're not as busy as we say we are. Sfarno has a famous comment. The first mitzvah the Jews are given when we left Egypt is HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem, the new moon, the ability to sanctify time. I don't know if you were to ask me, what's the first mitzvah you give slaves? After 210 years, they finally attain freedom. What's the first mitzvah you give them? The ability to control the month? So the Sfarno says, yeah. You know what differentiates a slave from a free person? Whether they control their own time. A slave doesn't have control over their own time. A slave is owned by his or her master. A free person is able to control their own time. There's a book which changed my life, which I'd love to tell you all about, but I'm out of time. But I highly recommend, I don't get any cut from you for reading it, but it's a book by Greg McKeon called Essentialism. It's all about how to reduce your life to the essentials, how to prioritize your life. He has an amazing line in there. He says, if you don't prioritize your life, someone else will. Make no mistake, your life is being prioritized. If you don't prioritize your life, someone else will. We all have 168 hours in a week. It doesn't matter how much you're worth. It doesn't matter how healthy you are. You can't add more hours to the week. It's the only commodity you can't change. You can work harder and make more money. And you can exercise and diet and lose weight and become healthier. But nothing can be done to expand time. The same 168 hours in the week, every single one of us. And tonight in this program, we're all about asking ourselves how we want to use them. Will we prioritize our lives to find time for Torah learning, to be koveya itim l'Torah, to find the time to be able to grow, to be able to evaluate, to be able to constantly reinvigorate that sense of mission to change the world? But it begins with being a mevakish. You're not going to be excited about learning if you have no appetite to grow, to learn, to know. It's a pasuk we say every day in davening, both comes from Tehillim and Divrei Hayamim. Yismach leiv mevakshi Hashem. Let the hearts of those who seek Hashem rejoice. The Chafetz Chaim says, you know, when it comes to any other pursuit, if you don't accomplish the goal, then the effort was not valuable. You didn't achieve the result. There's one exception. If you're a mevakesh Hashem, you're engaged in Torah study, you break your teeth on the Gemara, you're trying to fight your way through the Navi, you're trying to understand what's going on in the Mishnah, and you don't have clarity. Nevertheless, yismach leiv mevakshe Hashem. The joy it brings to your heart, the impact it has, the transformation it creates, even if you didn't achieve the result, even if you didn't get to the end, the truth. A mevakesh is thirsty for Torah. My daughter gave me a great insight. She's in Israel for the year. She heard it from one of her teachers. She shared this insight. You know, Torah is compared to water. Chumash tells us the Jews went through the desert 3 days without water. Chazal tells us it means they went 3 days without Torah. Water doesn't have a taste. It's delicious. Water is delicious proportional to how thirsty you are. Right? So if you go sit down for dinner, you have a delicious steak and fried onions, French fries on the side. Nobody says, would you bring me a glass of ice water to go with my steak? Nobody orders ice water. But if you just went for a 5-mile run, if you just finished playing basketball and you came back inside, there is nothing more delicious than cold water. So water is delicious based on how thirsty you are for it. And the same is true with Torah. Torah can be bland unless you're a mevakish. If you're thirsty, if you're curious, if you're inquisitive, if you want to learn and you want to grow, it's the attitude we bring towards it and the attitude our children and grandchildren see that we bring towards it that has the impact. So I'll end with a story. Isidore Isaac Rabi was a physicist. He was a Nobel laureate who was recognized for his discovery of nuclear magnetic resonance, which you might think has no relevance to your life, but it does because it's used in every MRI machine. He was born into a religious Jewish family in Hungary, came to the United States as a young child. I found a letter in the New York Times in 1988. It was shortly after he died, and it tells an amazing story. This author who writes a letter to the New York Times after seeing the obituary for the Nobel laureate Isidore Isaac Rabi. And the author says that he asked Rabi, "Why did you become a scientist rather than a doctor or a lawyer or a businessman like the other immigrant kids in your neighborhood?" So listen to what he answered. "My mother made me a scientist without ever intending it. Every other Jewish mother in Brooklyn would ask her child after school, 'So, did you learn anything today?' But not my mother. She always asked me a different question. 'Izzy,' she would say, 'did you ask a good question today?' That difference, asking good questions, that's what made me a scientist." Judaism is not a passive religion. We're about to engage a holiday of questions, of asking, of curiosity, of being a mevakish. That's our Masorah. That the guarantee of Jewish continuity, the transmission of our values to the future, is only when we create an environment of being a mevakish. Not did you learn anything today, but did you ask a good question today? We have to ask questions and cultivate an environment of curiosity and inquisitiveness. I'll tell you, in our community in Boca Raton, we realize that there's a mass who are going through the motions of Judaism, but they're uninspired. And the effort and the resource and the time that we put into that demographic yield little returns for what's being put in. It's a cynical, sort of turned-off demographic. So we've tried to do strategically, and I share it with you only because we're seeing the success and reaping the benefits. And I applaud you for what's happening here tonight. We created, on the one hand, the Beis Medrash of Boca Raton Synagogue and the Women's Midrashah, two entities that are promoting learning at all levels, learning opportunities that are created a community within the community of learners, and a certain kind of peer pressure and a pride of the community of learners within the greater community. And at the same time, we're working very hard on outreach. We have an outreach rabbi as part of our shul, outreach initiatives. And you know what's happening? Someone who's uninspired finds themselves sitting in shul next to someone who just drove here, has never been to an Orthodox shul, never seen what Shabbos is all about, but is willing to give up their golf or their beach day or their Saturday because there's something so compelling on one side of them. And on the other side is somebody who comes on a weeknight to learn in the Beis Medrash, who comes on a Sunday morning to attend a Chabura, who Torah, there's such an appetite and thirst that Torah is so delicious. And when you see the beginner, the uninitiated, find it so compelling, and the person who's advanced finding it so compelling, you can't help but ask yourself, maybe it's worth revisiting. There's something special in this for me. So I want to congratulate you and applaud you on creating a community of learners within the greater community, and to give a bracha that this Beis Medrash, this learning initiative, should grow, the bookcases should add on and add on, the space should be too small for the people who come to learn, and that all of us should get the incredible feeling of Yismach Lev Mevakshe Hashem, to be part of a community who are thirsty and hungry, who are searching and seeking God, should feel the reward of Yismach Lev, the fulfillment, the joy, and the satisfaction. Thank you so much for having me.